I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and welcome to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. Join us as we explore the latest advances, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we sit down with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Chris Verkemmen. Chris is the medical director at Remo Health and a general internist specializing in geriatrics and palliative care. He earned his medical degree from UCSF, where he also completed his internal medicine residency and served as chief resident at the San Francisco VA Medical Center. Chris has worked across hospitals, long-term care facilities, and clinics with a consistent focus on compassionate, high-quality care. Prior to Remo, he was the medical director of the Providence 65-plus age-friendly clinic in Tustin, California, and provided primary care at St. Jude Heritage Medical Group in Yorba Linda. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Chris, let's start with the basics. You have a focus in geriatrics and palliative care. How is geriatrics, in particular, a role that's different from other types of primary care doctors?
I think having been a primary care doctor my whole career, whether working only with older adults in geriatrics or all ages, primary care, we tend to organize care around medical problems. So someone has heart failure, that's a medical problem that we create a plan for, high blood pressure, whatever it might be. And it's not that we ignore those things when we're focusing on older adults in geriatric care. It's that they fit under a different context. The organizing principle would be the five M's is usually what you'll hear people in geriatrics talk about. It's a different way of grouping people's medical problems towards providing more, I would say, holistic care to older adults and really framing care around what's important to the individual in their lives.
And what are the five M's?
The one I'll start with, which is the one I think is most important, and I think many people in this field would agree, actually starts with a W. It's what matters, but the matters is the M. What matters is really getting at what brings them joy, what are things they do in their life that are really important to them. And then we try to frame the way we provide the care around what matters. And it includes advanced care planning and advanced directives, but it's much more than that. It's really getting at what the person sees as the things they do in their life that makes them who they are. The other M's would be medications, understanding that medications, both prescribed and over-the-counter, affect older adults differently than they might someone younger. Mentation, which would be cognition, which is what dementia would fall under, mild cognitive impairment. The newer addition would be the multimorbidity, which means recognizing that older adults often have many medical problems that coexist at the same time and interact in sometimes unpredictable ways, and being mindful of those things when we're providing treatment plans. And then nutrition, malnutrition would be part of the 5M framework too, making sure that our older adults are getting adequate nutrition. Those two kind of go together. So I'm giving you 6 M's. I guess that's not fair, but malnutrition and multimorbidity are important. And then the last one that's actually part of the 5 M's is mobility, meaning can you stand up? Can you walk? Can you get yourself around in a way that allows you to do those things that are really important to you?
I know that when I learned how to organize my thoughts as a doctor, it was very much in this problem list format. Like you said, heart failure might be a problem, sleep apnea might be a problem, kidney failure might be a problem. And because that's how I type my notes and because that's how I organize my thoughts, it can sometimes be easy to miss the big picture and think about things like function and nutrition and mobility and things like that. So I'm wondering, how do geriatricians account for all of the medical problems that their patients have while also keeping that more holistic lens? When you're organizing your thoughts, typing up your notes, are you actually typing out the 5 M's, or how are you keeping track of all those moving parts?
My personal practice may be different from others, and given that I've gotten my geriatric education, outside of fellowship and still haven't made it back to do fellowship. Maybe one day will, but I tend to use them as an organizing principle in that I will write out the five M's and then I'll take individual medical problems and I may touch on pieces of them within. So like for heart failure, let's say they're at a later stage. Well, I will include that under what matters in advanced care planning because I want to make sure that we're talking about planning for the event that things progress to a point where it's harder and harder to deliver curative focused treatment. But I also might put it under medications because they may be on medicines that are good for their heart but are also causing dizziness or other side effects that they find bothersome that could be affecting their nutrition too. So that's an example of how a medical problem can weave its way through multiple M's. And I just touch on it in that component part that I'm addressing in each part of my note and my assessment.
Every medical note talks about medications. It's one of the most common questions people get asked when they go to the doctor. What medications are you taking? But that question is especially important for older adults. Tell us why. Tell us why the medication list is such a priority and such a place of focus in older patients.
Every medication that you put in your body can have a side effect, and they can often be unpredictable in older adults due to the way their bodies break down the medicine or metabolize it, what sort of substances that breaking down creates. Sometimes it can create other chemicals that can act on the body independent of the original chemical form they were in. It's also the day-to-day living. If you're taking 20 medications, it's really hard to swallow that many pills or take that many injections, keeping track of when you're supposed to do them, how you're supposed to do them. The potential financial costs of being on many medications. Medications are a great example. They are one of the five M's, but they show up in every category of the M's. Can be what matters. I'm tired of taking these meds. I feel like they make me feel tired. They make my stomach hurt. They make me not want to eat. They make me dizzy. It's hard for me to get up and garden because I feel like I'm going to fall over. So we treat the medication list in this space very attentively because we know that many of the negative symptoms or things that people might not like the way they're feeling can be traced back potentially to a medication. And we also know that the benefits of the medications can change over time. A good example might be statin medications. We know that the trials that have looked at statin efficacy tend to be in people younger than age 75, and it's an open question of how much good they can do. It doesn't mean they don't do good. We just don't know how much. So we're constantly trying to balance, well, what are you getting out of this medication versus how might it be negatively affecting your life? And does that balance make sense for you or not? It may make sense at time one, but at time two, that balance may have changed and it doesn't make sense anymore.
You mean after age 75, that calculus may change?
Yeah.
So you've worked in many different settings. You've worked in the hospital. You've worked in long-term care facilities. You've worked in primary care. And something drew you to work with older adults. And I suspect you may have noticed that there's something missing in the care of older adults, especially those who are living with dementia. So talk to us about that gap that you saw, and then why you felt inspired to step into the gap and fill up that space.
I think it started in residency. The people who were teaching me clinical medicine, I tended to gravitate towards the geriatricians and the palliative care physicians as being ones whose view of medical care aligned with what mine was forming to be, really focused on functioning and making sure that what we're doing for people aligns with how they want to live their life. And that may not be according to the best evidence-based goal-directed therapy for whatever diagnosis they have. I like the emphasis on narrative and stories. Older adults often, just by virtue of having lived as long as they have really amazing stories that tie in the history that we learn in school to their own personal lived experience. And I personally just enjoy having those conversations with older adults and getting to know them in their capacity of the life they used to live. I think our society tends to create a caricature of older age that doesn't fit with how most of my patients who are older see themselves and how they live their life. And I also saw all the ways that the system came up short in providing care, whether it's the hospital, not letting people sleep, eating food that's different than they're used to eating, and then almost putting it back on the patient when they act in a way that the hospital staff may find disruptive, but really it's just, well, yeah, you're in a place where you can't sleep and you can't eat normal food and they're poking you all the time and that would make everyone upset. And isn't there a better way to do things? I think that was the driving principle through my whole time of training, was there's got to be a better way than this. And then in my first job, where I was seeing people across all the settings of care, every place had its own drawbacks, whether it was the hospital or a skilled nursing facility, where if you can't get up and do things for yourself, it can be a very isolating experience to be in bed most of the day. And it's not because people are trying to actively harm you, but because the system doesn't provide the staffing and support that folks need in those places to attend to their basic needs. And with that goes a significant loss of dignity and control. And all those things just did not sit well with me. And after trying out primary care, long-term care, hospital medicine, I ended up in a place where I was like, gosh, I feel like I'm running out of places to try and see where we can do this. And my last role as a medical director for an age-friendly clinic was closer, but then it wasn't deemed profitable enough for whatever reason. It wasn't picked up as a long-term plan. And Remo, I had come to because I wanted to work with them for my older adults in our clinic. I wasn't exactly looking for a job. I just wanted help to take care of people who had dementia and cognitive impairment. And at the end, I was actually ready to go back and do my fellowship and instead was offered a job here. And here I am.
And talk about why you decided to come on to Remo full time.
I saw an opportunity where the mission and the vision really aligned with what I had been trying to do in my professional life up until that point, which was to take on a very hard job proposition, which is to provide excellent comprehensive care for people with dementia and the people taking care of them, do it virtually, and do a better job than what most of us as primary care doctors had access to for our patients. And those of us who've been in the caregiving role, as I have been too, what we were able to find on our own. And Remo was the only place I was looking at that offered the promise of being able to do that. Turning it into reality is a lot of work, and that's what we try to do every day, and we're not there yet. But at the very least, I'm working with a wonderful group of people who are all committed to the same vision and making this happen as soon as we can and reaching as many people as we can to help them.
In addition to learning from your patients, it sounds like you do have some personal experience. You just mentioned having some experience as a caregiver that additionally inspired you to move in this direction with your career. And I was wondering if you'd be willing to share a bit about that. I think for most people at Remo, this problem is personal to an extent. So tell us about that.
Yeah, not just people at Remo, but so many of our patients, even before they themselves developed dementia, had seen it before in another family member. It really is such a pervasive experience for many of us. For me, it was with my grandpa, my mom's dad. His name is Mike. He was born in the 30s, served in Korea in the Navy. His parents were migrant farm workers and laborers from Mexico, and he went from that and the Central Valley to, again, the Navy. He was a postal service worker. He was just always working. Like, if I have any work ethic, it's because of him and my dad. And it was really hard to see him go from this robust, strong, even when he was in his 60s, being able to like hoist a refrigerator up into the back of his truck to take it to the dump with just a little bit of a ramp, to barely being able to walk on his own, losing the ability to talk when he used to tell these amazing stories about his life. And that process of seeing someone who was such a formative piece in your childhood and what you envision it's like to be an adult and a dad, and to see that slowly fall away over the course of years, as it does in his type, which he had Alzheimer type dementia. It goes without saying, it was really hard. And the grieving process is a little different than my dad, who died of cancer. It was more traditionally fast, whereas with dementia, the grief is stretched out over such a long period of time that by the end, you almost feel worn out. It's like when he finally did die, of course, I was sad, but I had spent a lot of time being sad. And so it wasn't as intense, but the time period was longer. In terms of the care, it was really hard. When he started to exhibit more signs, I was in med school and got used to those late night calls that grandpa's back in the ER because he fell, or we thought he was having a stroke, or whatever it might be. And then driving out to where I grew up, which is about an hour from where we trained for residency in med school, it starts to take its toll. And you feel like, I wish there was more I could do to keep him from being here and keep him being home where he's really happy. And in the end, he couldn't be at home anymore because my grandma wasn't able to care for him. And that was really hard. I think that helps. Obviously, the lived experience helps with empathy with patients and families, but it also fuels my, I joke, but I think about this stuff all day, every day. It never goes away. And I think it's because of experiences like that with my grandpa that I want to be here doing this work.
You talked about some of the gaps you saw for older patients when you were working in these different care settings. But talk about the gaps for dementia patients in particular. I don't know if you want to use your personal story as an example, or maybe there's a patient or two examples that demonstrate the ways in which our current system falls short when dealing with a disease as complex as dementia, which is medical, but also behavioral and financial. Talk about what's missing.
The first time I felt a hint of, there's something going on here, more than what I was taught in medical school, let's say, was an older gentleman we took care of when I was an intern at UCSF, who had hypoactive delirium, meaning he would not interact with staff. He would not interact even with his wife, who would visit him faithfully every day. And his hospitalization was extended to weeks because of this. And we did all these things. We did all these scans, all these procedures. We took fluid out of his spinal column to see if something was wrong there. And at the end, we really couldn't find anything. So we sent him back home, and his wife was really scared because she didn't know what was going on either. And this person in front of her wasn't the person she knew. A few months later, I was now a second year resident and rotating through the neurology clinic at UCSF. And I see this gentleman in the hallway, and he was alert. He was talking to one of the medical assistants in the clinic. And I stopped and I said, "Mr. So-and-so, I don't know if you remember me, but I took care of you in the hospital for weeks, and I'm just so happy to see you here looking the way you do." And he kind of stared at me like, "Who are you? What are you talking about?" And in reflecting on that, I said, "Man, we did so much, and the only way we fixed him was sending him out of the hospital." And that doesn't mean we don't try. We still try to make sure we're not missing something. But at the same time, when the treatment for a problem is removing you from the medical setting, it calls into question, well, what exactly are we doing in that medical setting for some people? Are we causing more harm than we think we are? So that was the first case that really stuck out to me for someone who has some cognitive impairment or dementia and how our system might not serve them well. I think a more recent experience I had was towards the end of my time at Providence in the age-friendly clinic. I had taken on a patient. She had such an interesting backstory. She was trained as an obstetrician gynecologist and worked in the Philippines her whole adult life. And she developed probably what was vascular dementia after a series of strokes. And where I saw the system falling short, even though we were in an age-friendly setting where we're supposed to be able to take better care of these folks, is her daughter was her main caregiver. And her daughter had a number of both medical and psychiatric problems that made it really hard for her to take care of her mom. And her dad in the house also had dementia, although not as advanced. And the only other family member was another daughter who lived a couple hours away. And what that taught me was, just because I can provide care for the person with dementia, not being able to attend to, in particular, the mental health needs of the caregiver in this case, made it virtually impossible for us to take the kind of care we wanted to of this patient. And unfortunately, she did die, and she died in the hospital. And I wish it hadn't been that way, because I know that the one thing that this patient was consistent in was she did not want to leave the house. And we weren't able to make that happen because we weren't able to support the caregiver in the way that she needed. And she needed a lot of support. So one of the other reasons I wanted to come here was we make it explicit that caring for the caregiver is on the same par as caring for the patient. And that's something our system isn't really built to do. We treat caregivers as almost an appendage when they're a central component of the care of people with dementia. So that most recently is one that sticks out and that I think about a lot in how our system just is not built to meet the needs of not just the person with dementia, but their family, their friends, everyone who cares about that person or cares for that person needs to be involved in their care. Even my clinic, when I first came, wouldn't bring family members in because they thought the rooms were too small. And I would just say, shoot, we got to cram everyone in there. I need everyone in there or else I can't do my job. So even things like that, just the built space sometimes isn't amenable to taking good care of these folks and the people who care for them.
In both of those stories, I think a lot about the built space. So in the first story where he couldn't get better until he left the hospital, just thinking about the lights and the noises and the food and everything's foreign and how people with dementia who are in the hospital can get so confused because the environment is really chaotic. And then in the second story, like you said, somebody who expresses again and again that they want to age in place, they want to die at home, and then that ends up not being possible for one reason or another, or they end up going to the hospital when that's not in their wishes, or spending a long time having things done to them in the hospital when that's not their wishes. And it makes me think about this telemedicine revolution that's happened, catalyzed in part by the pandemic. And obviously there's pros and cons to telemedicine, but it seems like a huge opportunity for dementia care for so many reasons. And was just wondering, you've worked in the hospital, you've worked in the clinic, and earlier you said the opportunity to come to Remo and to give this care and to give it virtually. What does the virtual medium and the telemedicine medium offer to people and families living with dementia that's unique and that can be supportive?
Yeah, you hit it on the head. COVID forced our hand to adopt this sink or swim. And while it was hard at times, what it opened my eyes to was now I could reach a group of my patients that, of course, I care dearly for and want to provide care to. We take for granted being able to get in our car and drive to see our doctor. And it's not until you learn from people for whom that is a great undertaking, how much we're asking of people and how unfair that can be. That was my first lesson from the pandemic was, wow, I now have this entryway to folks that I didn't have before. And I came to appreciate that that was better than not knowing and assuming everything was okay just because I wasn't hearing from someone or seeing someone. So that was my first real moment of realization at how powerful telehealth could be in this space. I think more specifically, more recently, a good example, I had a patient, it was a husband and wife. They lived in a suburb out here in Orange County that was pretty far away from my clinic. And they'd lived there their whole life, and both were adamant they would never leave this house. And they had just switched caregivers from one daughter to the other because the first daughter could not do it anymore. She was completely worn out, understandably. So another daughter from across the country moved out here to care for them. And I did some home visits with them because the mom or wife in this case who had dementia would not leave the house. She adamantly refused. She would not go see a doctor. Did not matter how important it seemed to everyone else, she just would not. So I started with home visits, but transitioned to virtual care, which allowed me to help this caregiver, this daughter, who was already near the end of her rope, understandably so, trying to care for her parents with dementia and be able to maintain ongoing regular contact, not just me, but my whole team, where even something as simple as her being able to send a message and get it responded to the same day. We do that all day, every day. But to her, that was such a new and important experience where she felt supported. Even if we couldn't fix the core dynamic at home, she felt more supported. And that was the best thing we could have done in that case. And it was facilitated by telehealth, and it was facilitated by understanding that things we take for granted, like being able to just go to our doctor, are not things we should expect to have for our whole life. There are a whole litany of things we get used to doing when we're younger that can be taken away from us. Even driving, this patient would become enraged when she wasn't able to get in her car and drive. And there's a wealth of literature and stories about how losing driving, especially in a place like Southern California, is losing a huge part of your independence and your autonomy. And so any way we can bridge those geographic gaps and functional gaps with technology, I'm all here for, and I see the virtual component of what we're doing as being right now the best way to do that.
You said that in this particular case, she was able to reach you, but she was also able to reach your team. Tell us more about the team for the patient and the family living with dementia. It's so much more than just having a doctor. Who else is on the team, and why is that interdisciplinary approach just so important in dementia care?
What you always hear from the geriatricians is geriatrics is a team sport. Same with the palliative care doctors. Palliative care is a team sport. And it's not lip service. You have to have a certain degree of humility to know where your expertise ends and where other people's begins. I think any good doctor in any field, geriatrics or not, has that inherent sense. And so the team is built to cover as many of those 5 M's and as much of that space as we can with folks who have true expertise in those domains. So the mobility domain, physical therapists, occupational therapists, they are the subject matter experts in mobility and functioning. We can identify where there might be gaps, but in terms of addressing them, those are the professionals that we lean on to do that for us. For what matters, it could be someone on the clinical team. Like in palliative care, we have chaplains who can help provide spiritual guidance and counseling for people who have serious illness. But it can also be someone outside the team. It can be a trusted person in the community who can tap into what matters, and they become part of the team. They become part of who we can connect with and leverage to make sure we're getting what the person needs to age in place if that's their wish and their goal. We have pharmacists who are also doctors who are highly specialized in their field and know way more about these medications, these substances, how they interact in the body with each other, with the aging body, and can help make sure that we are maintaining as parsimonious and safe a medication list as we can. So the team really is designed to cover all those domains of geriatric care and dementia care included. So the team in the cognitive space can be a physician, but it can also be an occupational therapist. It can be a speech language pathologist. It can be a neurologist. It can be a mental health professional like a psychiatrist or whoever, a counselor, a therapist, whoever that might be on the team to meet the needs of the person where they're at. Because while we try to predict and be proactive about what will happen next in a person's journey with dementia and their family, sometimes we can't. And so we need to have everyone ready to step in when needed. And a lot of times that isn't the doctor. A lot of times that can even be someone who's not a licensed clinician, like one of our care navigators, but someone the family trusts. Like my care navigator in my last job, people would call specifically for her just because they knew she would listen to them and she would make them feel safe and cared for. And that to me was like, okay, we're hitting our stride as a team when we're making that happen, because that's really what we want to be for people.
And how is Remo taking this ethos of interdisciplinary care and teamwork and realizing it and making it the standard? Because the unfortunate reality is it isn't the standard. So tell us about what that looks like at Remo and what you're excited about in that realm.
It's exciting because, one, it's explicit in the model. It's easy to say you value an interdisciplinary team. It's easy to say that you value different modes of expertise. But unless you put it in paper and say, this is who we're going to have and who we're going to work with, and we're going to hire them and employ them as experts in their field. It's easy to get away from that. I think the unfortunate reality in American healthcare is a lot of the structure is driven by billing, and physicians we can bill the most. So systems that are built to incentivize people seeing doctors more and physical therapists less may be more lucrative, but probably not the best for, in particular, people living with dementia, older adults who need more support with their mobility and their well-being. Even physical therapy, it's meant to be a time-limited treatment. And if you're thinking about someone who got a knee replacement and needs to rehab, sure, that makes sense. But for someone who has a movement disorder like Parkinson's disease, they always need to be exercising and to be guided and monitored in a way to maximize their functioning. And of course, good physical therapists have their workarounds for that, but fundamentally, the system doesn't recognize that as an ongoing need. So at REMO, we're very explicit in saying the interdisciplinary team is who is caring for the person with dementia and everyone caring for them. It is not just the physician. It is not necessarily even a physician-led team. Sometimes it might be, but sometimes it might be a social work-led team, and sometimes it might be a care nav-led team, depending on the person with dementia we're trying to help and depending on the situation. We also are very explicit about not treating it hierarchically. We treat it based on expertise and ability, and that can change from situation to situation. That's what makes it different, is we're not letting the billing drive the construction of the team, or how many times can you see this person or that person. We're basing it truly off of what does the patient and their family need right now, and who on the team is best suited to meet that need. And we want to make sure we have those people ready whenever the person with dementia and their families and their caregivers need them.
In addition to geriatrics, you have some expertise in palliative care. Tell us about palliative care, because I think sometimes the phrase palliative care is misunderstood by families. And specifically, I'm wondering how you think about palliative care as it relates to dementia. You mentioned earlier that your father, for example, died of cancer. And so palliative care for cancer looks a little different than it does for dementia. So talk about palliative care and dementia and how you think about that.
Like I said earlier, the people I looked up to most in my training were either geriatrics, palliative care, or both, because they had been around long enough because they'd been long enough to grandfather in, or because they took the time to do both sets of training. And like you said, a lot of the training that we were both exposed to in our training is in illnesses like cancer that are obviously serious illnesses, and sometimes illnesses that are not curable and do shorten life. Dementia can be that too, but again, in many cases, the process is so drawn out. And that is something that's very hard to do as a person going through it and as a person helping someone go through it. The core tenets of providing medical care to people with serious illness are the same in dementia as with other illnesses, but the time course is certainly a difference. Some dementias move faster than others, but by and large, we're talking years. And the need to involve the family and caregivers is still there in both. The attendance to not traditionally medical concerns like spirituality, the life you live outside of the clinic when you're visiting, or whatever your medication list or whatever your scans say, it's much more looking at the whole person and trying to optimize care for the whole person in their situation. My experience in having done it in training and as a mid-career physician compared to what it looks like for people with dementia, if anything, there's more time to develop a closer relationship with the family and the person with dementia, which I find fulfilling. I can think of a patient who I met. He was interesting in that he had both dementia and cancer, and his cancer was what ultimately caused his death, but his cognitive status diminished over time too, as one would expect as he declined from his dementia. And that patient and his family I became very close to, and they were well known in the community I live in, and it was an interesting experience to have people that I knew through other parts of my life asking me about, you know, obviously I could only share so much because he's a patient and he deserves his privacy, and so do the family. But that I found very different from how it felt a lot of times doing it in the hospital, or even as a primary care doc. If I have someone who I am only just meeting who's been diagnosed with an advanced illness like cancer or some other incurable illness, the time course is more prolonged. So it forces you to develop a tighter therapeutic relationship with the family. And you're also in the practice of providing a lot more anticipatory guidance the way a pediatrician might deliver. And I don't mean to infantilize people with dementia. That's not my intent. But oftentimes the families want to know, well, what's going to happen next? Is what I'm seeing now the new normal, or will it get better? And in the early stages, it can be hard to know that. And so being that constant source for the back and forth is a little bit different, I think, than the kind of palliative care that we're used to seeing in the hospital, for instance, where the relationship is focused on a few weeks sometimes, particularly if it's right at the end of life, or even in outpatient palliative care. The palliative care for folks with dementia lasts longer, and it's still all encompassing through the five M's. I mean, there's obviously overlap with geriatric care and palliative care. They're not the same thing, but we want to focus on people's nutrition, on their pain, on their comfort, on other symptoms, similar to how we would do in an outpatient palliative care clinic where we're doing symptom management. So there's a lot that's the same, but I found what was most different was the degree of time and also the uncertainty. I should hype on that too. Unfortunately, with my dad having advanced stage lung cancer, not perfectly, but you could pretty well predict how things would go from a timeline, whereas dementia, as all the textbooks say, once you've seen one case, you've seen one case. Sometimes people can go much slower or much faster, and that can be hard to navigate for families and hard to navigate as a clinician too, because sometimes we get surprised and that can affect us too in the way we're delivering that care.
There's a lot of decisions that families have to make when their loved one has dementia. For example, should we start this new medication? Should we start this new infusion? Is it worth the side effects? Is it worth the risk? Is it worth the cost? And then there's other decisions like, is it time for my loved one to stop driving? Is it time to hire a caregiver in the home? Or is it time to think about transitioning out of the home and to a care facility? What about a feeding tube? There's just so much as you get closer and closer to the end of life that needs to be navigated. And in palliative care, we talk a lot about this concept of shared decision making. So when those decisions come, families aren't alone. They don't have to make those decisions alone. We, the care team, are here to guide them through that. It doesn't mean that we decide for them. It's like the phrase says, shared decision-making. So talk about shared decision-making and how do you think about that? And what does that look like in day-to-day conversations with patients and families?
A big part to me of good shared decision-making, and one of the, I would say, luxuries of doing it in outpatient care, is we have time to get to know the person and their family. Having been on the other end of palliative care consults where we don't have that time, it's very different in how to approach it. I think the principles are the same, but you have a compressed amount of time and you have to accept that this family's not going to have the time to get to know you, and you have to build trust very rapidly. We have the luxury of time in the beginning. So I front load a lot of that time with really getting to know the person, the patient, and getting to know more about their family. So my first visit is, of course, I want to get information on their medical problems and whatnot. But another way where this differs is I spend much more time, where were you born? What was your childhood like? Did you grow up on a farm? Did you grow up in an urban area? Are you from another country? And you start to truly build this person's history up in a way where it helps me understand why they might want certain things or not want certain things. I think of a patient of mine that I cared for years who was born in the Middle East and had experienced the political violence that has gone on often there for at least for the last century fairly frequently, and had trauma because of it. And he came to the United States and started his own business, and that business was truly so important to him that he could run and maintain a business and take care of his family in a place where he felt safe and they felt safe. When his cognition made it difficult for him to run that business and no one else in the family was able to take it over for him, it became the central sticking point of making any decisions for him, whether it related to, do you want to stay in the home or not? Whatever it was, it all came back to, well, I need to keep running my business, even when that business became costlier to run than it was worth. And it got to the point where it was becoming clear that that was the thing that was holding up his family's ability to care for him, was his unwillingness, rightfully so, to give it up, because it was, apart from his family, the thing he cared most about in his life. And shared decision making in that context is very challenging, because we think we know what the right thing is. You should get rid of your business and take care of your family. But shared decision making, I think, also forces us as clinicians to step back and say, well, what value framework are we applying to this situation? Why do we think we know what the best thing is for this person? And that's very challenging. Shared decision making is also not handing someone a menu and saying, what do you want? I mean, you hear palliative care docs and professionals talk about it all the time, and it's very true. That's not really shared either. In fact, it can, to me, sometimes almost feels worse than not talking about it and making it something like, well, just pick what you want. Here's the menu. So coming back to the, how does it work in the dementia space? When we have someone who's earlier in stage and can participate more, that's the golden time to get as much information that we can from them about their story, about their values. And we keep updating that as time goes on and as things change. I was taught to use the values triad of looking at longevity, independent functionality, and avoidance of pain and suffering. Of course, we all want those three things, but there do come points in our life where we have to give up more on one to get more of the other. So introducing that concept early, I find helpful, because people can change over time, or sometimes people don't know. They put themselves right in the middle and say, you know what, I can't pick between those three right now. And knowing where we're starting from and how that's changed over time really informs helping people make a decision. Because what I do then is, when faced with a hard decision, is I go back to all the time that we've spent getting to know each other and say to the patient, we've gotten to know each other really well, and these things you've always told me are so important to you. Your business, I get it. You built that. It is something you're intensely proud of, and I'm not here to make you give that up. I want to see if you understand the impact it's having on your family, and then we can go from there and make a decision about what to do with it. Because if I just come in and say, well, you don't have capacity to make that decision, your family gets to sell it, whatever, that's not a very person-centered way to approach it. And we can probably get to that decision, as we did in this case, without having to do it that way. It's more time-consuming, but I think it's more human to do it the shared decision way.
Yeah, I think what you're saying about the importance of knowing someone and being known by someone over a period of time, you can't really buy that off the shelf. It takes time and it takes trust. And that is where some of the most effective medicine can happen, particularly in dementia care. So I really appreciated that. And I really appreciate you coming on to Remo to speak with us about your background and your passion. As we wind things to an end, I was just wondering if you could share with us what you hope for, what you think about when you think about the future of aging and the future of dementia care.
Obviously, central to me is providing amazing care for our patients and their families. But I also want to show the rest of the world that there's a way to do it and function within the American system, and that this doesn't have to be a luxury. It should instead just be the standard of care. And that'll take time. And we have a hard case to make, but we all believe it's the right case to make. And so my hope is that more people take up this mantle and say, it doesn't have to be the way it is right now. There's no reason, even something we take for granted, folks like you and me in our era of training, like a clinic, it doesn't have to be a clinic. Medical care can be delivered in all sorts of places. The clinic is more an accident of history than anything. So having more people that are willing to question, even the things that we think are, this is the way it is, and say, why are things this way? My hope is that we can all be ambassadors and evangelize for this idea of, we can question the way things are done as it pertains to aging and dementia care. It's okay to say, maybe this isn't the best way to do it. Could we try it a different way? Oh, there's no evidence for it? Well, of course there's not. No one's tried it. So let's try it. Let's make evidence and see if it works or not. And being willing to do that. And I think if people trust you and know that you're trying to help them go through a really, really hard thing, they're willing to go pretty far with you, has been my experience. And to help you, they get excited to be part of that process. And that's how I hope folks who come to get care at Remo feel, that they're part of something, not just care for themselves, but of trying to make this better for everybody in this country. People deserve the best care, and we think it can be a lot better than how it is now.
We've talked a lot about how the current healthcare system is not set up ideally for families and people living with dementia, and how there's a lot of changes that need to be made at the level of the providers and clinics and thinking about telemedicine and things like that. But that's going to take some time. Remo is definitely a part of that solution, but it's going to take some time for these new innovative models to grow and flourish. So in the meantime, is there anything that families and caregivers can do inside the existing system to advocate for themselves and to get the care that they need?
Part of my teaching to families and patients, I use the 5M framework. You don't need a medical degree to understand it. It's talking about what matters, being very upfront with your doctor, anyone you're dealing with, about here are the things that are really important to my dad. He wants to stay home. He wants to keep working in the garage on his little inventions and his little gadgets he likes to build. And he wants to keep mowing his own lawn. Those are like really important things. Leading with that is totally fair. And if you get pushback or it doesn't seem to make sense, that's another sign you're seeing that this isn't a system or a place where you're going to get the help you need. Or if someone's receptive to it, that's a good thing. At Remo, we'll help you with that. But I think leading with what matters is always good. Medication, same thing. Keeping an up-to-date med list, or if you can't, recognizing that that's a problem and probably means it's too complicated and too big. Bringing that to your appointments and saying, there are a lot of medicines on here. Do we really need to be on all these medications? Totally fair question. Nutrition, keeping track of what folks are eating, encouraging them to eat food they like, honestly. We don't need to be micromanaging people's diets. We want people to eat food that they enjoy. Ideally, we sneak some protein in there and we keep the weight pretty steady, but being mindful of nutrition patterns can be a sign of progression of a dementia syndrome to a later stage. And mobility, advocating for mobility, saying, you know what, my dad or my mom, or they're having a really hard time getting themselves out of bed and that really concerns me. What can we do to make that better? So I honestly would include the 5Ms in my teaching for people because they're intuitive and they make sense and you don't need a medical degree to understand them. And that's a great framework for people with dementia and their families to use to help guide their care, because all the 5Ms play into dementia. So even if I speak about geriatrics as a field, you can't do good dementia care without being mindful of mobility, of medication, of what matters, advanced care planning, and all the other considerations therein. So I would use it as a framework for self-advocacy too. I also believe we can't put all the onus on people. We have to change as a system too to make that easier. But this is a way that families can advocate and make it known that there's a need for this, make it known that this is important for people to pay attention to.
I wonder if doctors and other clinicians might actually welcome that kind of clear framework. Like, I'm imagining families listening to this and thinking like, ooh, I don't want to rock the boat. I don't want to tell my doctor what to do or tell my doctor what to focus on. But just reiterating that doctors may actually welcome this. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think most do. It gives us a target for what we're shooting for. That's not just, I wrote a prescription for this medication today, or I sent a referral to this specialist today. These are tangible things that really bring positive results that you can see. So I think, yeah, most clinicians would be. And what you're doing is you're taking the physician as an expert consultant and you're giving them a direction or something to aim for that's more than a number. And I would say most of the physicians that I've known in my time would very much welcome a meaningful target of treatment that goes beyond a certain lab value or the stuff we're usually held to in primary care. So I would say don't feel shy about that. And if you're feeling out a new doctor, I think how receptive they are to bringing up those concerns tells you a lot about how open they'll be to working with you towards them.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. I have been speaking with Dr. Christopher Kamen, general internist with a focus in geriatrics and palliative care, and medical director at Remo Health. Chris, this was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you for listening. For more information about this episode, check out the links and resources listed in the show notes. If you're interested in learning more from Remo, visit us at www.remo.health. Take care.